Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you again for joining us here on this latest edition of our SPME BDS Monitor. We have a great program for you this afternoon, and I'm glad you have the opportunity to join us. My name is Asaf Romorowski. I'm the Executive Director of Scholars for Peace in the Middle East. With me this afternoon, we have Alex Jaffe, the editor of the BDS Monitor, and of course, we have our guest of honor, Brigadier General Reserve Yossi Cooperwasser. Cooperwasser is an Israeli intelligence security expert. Formerly, he served as the head of research division with the IDF. He was in charge of the. He was also the director general of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which is the same ministry responsible for the anti-BDS efforts in Israel. And he's currently a senior project manager at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs, specializing in security dimensions of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Yossi is a friend of SPME, and we are grateful for him taking the time to talk to us this afternoon about these critical issues and how they are seen from the other side of the Atlantic Ocean as it relates to Israel's national security. Let me just put out a few housekeeping rules. So everybody knows how the format will work this afternoon. Those of you who have joined us in the past, you know that Yossi will speak for about 20 minutes, and then we will open up the floor to as many questions. Those of you who are logged in through the computer, all you have to do is press the hand icon on the on your dashboard, and I will be able to unmute you, and you can ask your question. You can also write in a question via the chat, and I'll be able to read your question, and Yossi will tackle those questions as well. Obviously, we encourage as many questions as possible, and we will do our best to get to all of those questions in a timely fashion. If you're logged in through the phone, you too can press the prompt to ask a question, and I'll be able to unmute you as well. So without further ado, Yossi, thank you for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Asaf. Thank you, Alex. And thank you for everybody who's listening, because I don't know who exactly is there, so thank you for listening anyhow. What I would like to focus about is to explain why this new anti-Semitism that we are facing in the last, I would say, something like 30 years, is actually really anti-Semitism. Of course, it is presented as some sort of anti-Zionism. It is presented as some sort of fighting for human rights, using noble values as the ideas that you are trying to promote, and pretending that Israel is the oppressor and the colonial power, and because of that it's important to fight against it, and this has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, because these people are not against Jews. These people are just against Zionism and against the State of Israel, and by that they actually of course try to mislead everybody, because in the end of the day, this new anti-Semitism is about the collective Jew, about Israel. Now, some people may claim that in the past, yes, it was true that people could have been against this idea, and they were even good Jews, like the Bund and many other Jews along the history were not very fond of Zionism. But today, we are definitely in a totally different situation, where Zionism is the national liberation movement of the Jewish people, and the Israel is a state that exists and protects the Jewish people and gives the Jewish people an opportunity to have self-determination and to guarantee its security and prosperity. So it's not about what happened in, say, 100 or 120 years ago, but we are in a different situation now, and going against the collective Jew, against Israel, against Zionism, is anti-Semitism. And we all know that the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism took that into consideration and included the 3Ds as a sort of anti-Semitism to make it clear for those who are trying to hide behind these noble values that this is unacceptable, and actually using delegitimization, demonization, and double standards towards Zionism and towards Israel is anti-Semitism. That said, criticizing Israel is totally legal, and most Israelis criticize Israel as well, so we don't have any problem with criticism. But criticism is one thing, and anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism is something totally different. Now, what is this anti-Semitism in its new form trying to do? It takes the 7 points that constitute the Palestinian narrative and try, just like the Palestinians inside the Palestinian territories and within the Palestinian people are trying to make sure that these 7 points are inculcated into the Palestinian psychological infrastructure and turn into incitement when needed, incitement to violence when needed. The same idea is about those anti-Semites. They want to make sure that the international community accept those 7 points and follows them as the way to look at the Israeli or Jewish Palestinian conflict. And let me just mention those 7 points that constitute the Palestinian narrative. First of all, there's no Jewish people. And the Judaism is just a religion, and because of that, Jews do not deserve the right of self-determination. Secondly, there is no sovereign history of the Jews in Palestine, or in the land of Israel, as the Jews would call it. And because of that, there is no issue of the Jews coming back. They are actually colonialists that creates their state there without any justification. And there is no archaeological, and Alex can speak about that maybe. There is no archaeological remnant that proved that there was a Jewish state in Palestine, and so on and so forth. This sounds totally crazy, but this is what the Palestinians have to believe in and what they are trying to convince the rest of the world to adopt. Third, Jews in general are problematic, but Zionists are totally unbearable. And this is why the international community wanted, the colonialists wanted the Jews to leave Europe and to get away from them. And they found this piece of land that didn't have a people in it, and decided to give the people without the land this land without the people. And the purpose of that was to serve the interests of the colonialists and to make sure that Islam will not be able to threaten the colonialist West, and later on the imperialist West, namely the United States. So therefore, the presence of a Jewish state in Palestine is a part of colonialism, and goes along with racism, because the Jews are such terrible creatures, and especially the Zionists, they are racist in their behavior. They bring with them apartheid, they bring with them their greediness, and so on and so forth. They're totally unacceptable. That's why number four is that the Palestinians have the right to struggle against Zionism in all ways, including sticking to the land, including BDS, which is one sort of battle and struggle, but at the same time they have the right to struggle through the use of force and violence. And the way they do that depends on their assessment of cost-benefit analysis. And that's why we have to understand BDS is not against violence. BDS is a complementary way of action in the basket of options that is available to the Palestinians in fighting the existence of the State of Israel. Number five in this 7 points is that the Palestinians are the only victims of the conflict, and because of that, their victimhood should be eternalized until the conflict is solved. The conflict will be solved only when this unjust presence of the Jews in Palestine will come to an end. And this is why when you look at the goals of the BDS, you find the idea of the bringing back the refugees to their original homes, which means that Israel will disappear, and that's as a nation state of the Jewish people. And this is clear, very clear as another part of this narrative that is being fed by this group. Number six is that they represent both Islamic and national Palestinian goals, and these two cannot be separated. This is very important in the sense that they cannot show any kind of readiness to give up any of their demands. And number seven is that, and this is the most important one, that they actually, the battle is on all of Palestine. From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And yes, they are ready to all kinds of steps in underway. This is the phaser theory of 1974. They are committed to it, or some of them are committed to it, most of them. But this doesn't mean that they give up on Haifa, Jaffa, Tiberia, and whatever, because eventually the battle is for all these territory. And these are the 7 points that all the Palestinians that promote BDS and all those who adopt BDS has to fight for. And strangely enough, they manage somehow to convince more and more people to adopt it using this guise of honorable, peaceful struggle against all kinds of injustices. The idea of the of these radicals that promote this BDS is that there is a chance for them to convince more and more people to adopt it by this pretension of goodwill and non-violence. And strangely, what we see in recent years is that these ideas slowly infiltrate from the extreme radical fringes of society, mainly on the left-hand side, towards the center. And this is why I think that the new anti-Semitism poses a national security threat for Israel because of two major reasons. One is that what Israel stands for is the nation state, is being the nation state of the Jewish people. And once you manage to promote these 7 points in all kinds of international fora and in the minds of all kinds of liberals or left-leaning liberals, then the ability of Israel to be seen as such and to accept international legitimacy as such is eroded. And this is not happening all of a sudden, but the way people speak about the conflict reflects that. For example, everybody speaks in the West about the two-state solution. This is the Palestinian version of the first phase of the phaser theory, two-state solution, not two states for two peoples. Now, it takes a long time to explain to anybody that, listen, there's a difference between two-state solution and two states for two peoples solution. Because only in the second one, and once you say that one of them is the nation state of the Jewish people, then there is the idea of Israel is being served by this notion. But most people just say, we support the two-state solution. The two-state solution means that there can be two states with none of them being a nation state of the Jewish people. This is exactly what the Palestinians are for. So this is a very dangerous threat. And we saw it in many international resolutions that speak about the two-state solution instead of speaking about two states for two peoples, one of them being the nation state of the Jewish people that should be recognized as such by the Palestinian state that's going to be to live in peace next to it. That's one problem. The second problem is that Israel needs the support of the West in order to have enough freedom to protect itself, enough political freedom, enough military freedom, enough legal freedom, and enough economic freedom. We are reliant on the West for being able to protect ourselves. We have this rule that we shall always protect ourselves by ourselves, and this is extremely important, of course. But in order to be able to protect ourselves by ourselves, we need the Western support, especially the American, of course. And when and we lived for a long time under the assumption that the joint values and the joint interest that we have, the common interest that we have with the United States, will guarantee this support. We shouldn't worry about that. But what is happening right now in the world, especially in the, as I said, the left-leaning liberals, is that they are already under, they have already adopted the vocabulary of the extreme radicals, of the progressives, as they're called somewhere, and the Islamists, another part of them. And they use this vocabulary. And once you start to use this vocabulary, you actually start to question your immediate support and unwavering support for Israel. And we saw it with what's happened with the Labour Party in Britain. And we saw what happened with Bernie Sanders, that is now considered to be a very legitimate member of the Democratic Party. And it's very important to make sure that his supporters will support Biden and so on and so forth. It's and because of that, what's happening is that the more sober liberals in the West are very cautious and not confronting the left-leaning liberals, and definitely not, and also not the progressives. We see it with whatever is happening with Ilhan Omar and their friends, Linda Sarsour, and so on and so forth. This fear of this unease of confronting them that keeps the Democrats in the States and the Labour Party in Britain and many other parties of the same kind from actually standing against this anti-Semitism. They definitely believe that they are not anti-Semites, and many of them are not. They want to believe that all they do is criticizing Israel, and maybe this is what they really mean. But by not confronting the extreme radicals, they let the vocabulary take over the entire liberal parts of the of these democracies. And this is extremely dangerous, especially as some of these people may eventually find themselves in leadership positions. So it may happen in the United States, and it may have happened in the UK. And this is a very dangerous situation for Israel that relies so deeply on that. Moreover, there is the fear that this policy strengthens the ultra-radical groups inside the Islamic world. Now, we are in a very unique situation now in the Islamic world, where we have better and better relations with the pragmatists in the Islamic world, in the Middle East especially, and beyond. And unfortunately, the liberals in the West find themselves confronting the pragmatists, trying to take action against the pragmatists, weaken them, and support the radicals, support the Muslim Brotherhood. And this is something that is sometimes beyond my understanding, but this is the case. They are supposed to be left-leaning people. Radical Islam is not exactly, should not be exactly their cup of tea, but they find themselves supporting Qatar, supporting Turkey, supporting to some extent even Hamas. It's unbelievable, but this is the case. And the people that make it happen are those Palestinians who promote those 7 points in this battlefield that's taking place around the world, especially in the West. Especially the PFLP and to a lesser extent Hamas is active in this respect, the Palestinian Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the PFLP. The ex-communists that together with the progressive that lost their cause celebre of supporting communism and now have turned to Israel destruction as their new cause celebre. And all of that is constitutes a threat to Israel's national security. And we have to confront it. So what to do about it? I would say, first and foremost, it's calling the spade a spade. We have to make sure that people understand that what they hear is anti-Semitism. And it's not easy to make them say so, because these are people from amongst us. These are people from they are in the party that are part of the party. Look at the paper that just came out, was leaked from the Labour Party in the UK. It's this is institutionalized anti-Semitism that was there in the party, And nobody was ready to say anything about it because these are our friends. These are our people. We want them to win the elections. So we want to win the elections with them. And this is something that keeps people from calling the spade a spade. And we have to make sure that this happens. For that to happen, I think we have to make sure that people adopt the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism. And not only adopt it as some general idea, as it was developed as some sort of non-binding definition, but also take some lessons from this and take some steps accordingly, just like the Bundestag in Germany did. And I must commend the Germans also for saying, again, calling a spade, saying that Hezbollah is a terror organization and all its parts. But the Germans and the Austrians have already said that BDS is anti-Semitic. And this is very important. It's amazing that the United States Congress is lagging behind Austria on that issue. This is something that has to happen. We should, in order to fight this battle, we should have people from within the liberals to participate in the battle, both Jews and non-Jews, especially non-Jews, because this is not about Jews. This is about the Western society. It's, we are the immediate victims of this anti-Semitism, but it's not only us. Everybody is a victim. And these people are the same people that fight against American values in general, not against America. It's not something that is confined only for Jews and for Israel. So it's very important that liberals will wake up, as I wrote in the essay, I wrote about it, where is the Emil Zolas of today? And I think also from Israel, we need some more involvement of Israelis in this battle. The Israelis look at it as something that's happening in some remote place. They don't really bother that much. We have a community here of people that came from the States, came from Europe, so they are more involved in that. But Sabres, the people that were born here and raised here, are less attentive to this threat and don't understand the national security magnitude of it. And eventually what we need is to spend more on education, on awareness, and demand professionalism for and real values from those who speak about it, and not let anybody say anything without being immediately responded to. And in general, I would say we have to move from defense to offense. We have to make sure that the ability of these people to convince more people with their strange ideas is limited. We have done that in recent years. We have come up with the idea and with the message that anti-Semitism, that anti-Israel is anti-Semitism on the one hand, and that anti-Israel is also very, the anti-Israel movement is also closely related to terror, and it's not peaceful, but it's just another manifestation of struggle that includes terrorism as well, and it supports the terrorism. These are things that have to be clarified to everybody when we fight on this issue. Last, let me say a word or two about the corona times. Of course, the BDSers and the entire opponents of Israel use this plague in a very devastating way in order to bash Israel. And I hope, read the paper just came out yesterday by SPME on what's happening in this front. I don't want to speak too much, but it's not only those people in the West. This is also coming again, like on the first issue, it's coming from the Palestinians. It's coming from those who are really not only cynical and see here an opportunity to bash Israel and to say that Israel is behind the plague and to say that Israel is worse than the corona and so on and so forth, and also trying to use this to mobilize the corona issue in order to promote their political goals, like easing the or removing the siege over Gaza or releasing the Palestinian terrorists who are in Israeli jails. It's not only the cynical issue of using the bashing of Israel in order to divert attention from their very poor investment in the health of their own societies, both the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, and of course the Iranians and then the Turks. But beyond all of that, it's a manifestation of their real belief that this may work, that people may really believe in it. Now, you say to yourself, nah, that cannot be. Who would believe that Israel is the bad guy in the context of, if at all, it's China, right? But listen, this is unbelievable. When you look at the report that was issued by the International Crisis Group, by Rob Malley, somebody who was in charge of the Middle East in the Obama administration. And you look at the report he wrote about Gaza, all of it based on all kinds of slanders against Israel that have nothing to do with reality. You say to yourself, wow, this may actually work. And he's not an ignorant person. And I can tell you, I know him very well. He's not an anti-Semite in the old way of thinking about anti-Semitism. And this is true not only for him, but for many others. And yet, this is the case. It reminds me very much of things we used to hear from all kinds of leaders that are not anti-Semites and still adopted the way of thinking of the radicals. Like, for example, that if we don't give up the occupation of the West Bank, then this would necessarily lead to apartheid and to Israel controlling all of the Palestinians and all kinds of things that have nothing to do with reality, let alone this notion that Israel, the Jews, don't have a connection to Jerusalem and so on and so forth. And to finish, I would say the way this eventually affects our national security was the best case of that was the UN Security Council Resolution 2334, promoted by President Obama, that actually adopted all the Palestinian ideas on what should happen in the West Bank and in Judea and Samaria from our point of view, and went so far as looking at the Wailing Wall as an occupied Palestinian territory. So it's this is one of the things that we have to deal with. It's, as I said, a national security threat to Israel that has to be answered in all the tools that we have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Yossi, for that comprehensive and in-depth analysis. Obviously, there is a great deal of lost in translation between the two sides of the Atlantic, and we're facing a great deal of problems, and there's a lot to discuss. First of all, the floor is now open with the time that we have. So again, anybody who has a question, and we encourage as many questions as possible, please hit the icon hand and I'll be able to unmute you. Or if you have a question, I'll be able to read your question. And then we'll go from there. While I'm looking through, Alex, do you want to start us off with the first question?
Sure. Well, let me also say thank you for your review. I'm curious about the perception of not only the Israeli national security apparatus regarding these issues, but the political echelon, which has obviously been very much in flux. I think there's a new government today. I'm not sure. I haven't read all the news. But we know that Prime Minister Netanyahu has been very very firm on some of these issues, but as have others within the political spectrum. But is it a widely shared perception that the new anti-Semitism, which includes BDS, which emanates mostly from the left, is a real national security issue or a public relations issue to be managed?
Oh, I don't think everybody will agree on what is it that we are facing. I think that the Prime Minister, I think I know Netanyahu quite well on this issue, and I think he understands this is a threat that we have to deal with. And this understanding of his was translated into some decisions to give money to operations that had to do with things that have to be done in this respect. And as you know, there is the Ministry of Strategic Affairs that its budget was raised dramatically 3 years ago. And I think that's that was a reflection of the understanding that this is something that we have to deal with. That said, not everybody is on the same page. You can hear many people in Israel saying, this is just because of political considerations inside Israel that we have to have this ministry and that we have to have a separate ministry for that purpose. And as a former director general of the ministry, I think this is not the case, because the idea with the ministry and the idea of the importance of it is that there is somebody who wakes up in the morning and this is what he does, and he has the capability to coordinate the activities of all the works of government in this respect. And this is important because the battle over the legitimacy of Israel is very, very diverse. It's on sports events, on culture, on legal issues, on press issues, foreign diplomatic activities, of course, and so on and so forth. So and the economy, and it's everywhere. So you got to be able to coordinate all these efforts and make sure that it's not a cacophony, but some order is in this concern. And there is an understanding in the upper echelons. Now, I think right now we have a golden opportunity because General Gantz, who is now going to be the next prime minister in this rotation government, if it ever comes true, was also very attuned to this matter. And when he left the military several years ago, one of the first things he did was to enter into this business of fighting for the legitimacy of Israel. And so I think on this issue they agree. I'm not sure everybody does, but there are enough people in the government to understand the importance of it and are ready to fight for it. They all understand that it has an impact not only on our political freedom, as I said, but also on our military ability to defend ourselves at the end of the day and on many other issues. And because of that, it's critical to be there and to fight against it.
I'll offer my perspective, which complements this, that my sense is that in Israel, in the political echelon, in the military echelon, there is a broad consensus, and at the highest level, there is some amount of concerted action, which is inconsistent in part because of politics. And this was treated at least 4, 5, 6 years ago as a kind of political issue. But certainly in the American context, I think that because it's like anything anything that Netanyahu in particular treats as a serious concern is automatically regarded as suspect or in an invented issue. And we saw this 10, 15 years ago with Iran, which is anything but an invented issue. And we've seen it to some extent with anti-Semitism and BDS in more recent times. And this, I think, is where it becomes a kind of public relations. There's a public relations dimension.
I think you give too much attention to the extreme, and you're not the only one. Many people give too much attention to the extreme left in Israel.
I'm talking about in the U.S.
Within
American public opinion and American Jewish public opinion, if Netanyahu says something, there is a segment that is automatically believes that it's false or invented, And this is why much of what we do with SPME is to try and get a non-political or an apolitical perspective out to the public on these issues that focuses in some kind of balanced way. We're neither for or against him in this sense or any other political candidates.
So in this context, I think maybe this unity government that I was totally in favor of can also ease the this problem, because people will understand this is not only Netanyahu. This is people. All Gantz is also on that. And by the way, also Yair Lapid is very much with this, and Bogi Yaalon is very much with the same thing, and the same is Lieberman. So it's the opposition today, and that issue they do not differ. It's, this is important. What is left is the three members of Meretz and the Arab List, the Arab Joint List. So the rest of Israel is united on the need to fight against it. How much money to give for that compared with other needs? This is another issue. But everybody agrees this is an important issue, and this can ease the criticism from people outside of Israel, because they know that Israel is united on that issue.
That itself is. Go ahead, Alex.
No, I'm just saying that there's some people with their hands up. So
That in itself is unity is always a miracle when it comes to these issues. That's quite telling in itself. Yes. So there's a few questions. A few that were sent in and a few that are on the phone. So let me start with Susan here, if we can connect our friend Susan. Let's see if we can. Susan, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can. Go ahead. The floor is yours.
Okay, thank you. I'm Susie Rosenbluth from the Jewish Voice and Opinion. My question has to do with how President Trump's action last Hanukkah, it was unveiled at the Hanukkah party, granting Title VI protection to students on campus, extending those protections, understanding and using the definition, the UN definition of anti-Semitism, recognizing that harassment of Jewish students on and using anti-Israel rhetoric. How is that going to help Israel fight this national security threat?
Well, I think that one of the, as I said before, there are many arenas in which this battle is being fought, and one of them is the American campuses. And I think that by making the point that the administration is not going to help those universities that promote BDS, is a very helpful step, because I think people will think deeper before they move
in
this direction.
It's more than just that he won't help them. It's that if the university, as many of the universities do, all you have to do is Google it, you'll see how many instances there are. If a university stands by and allows it, and that has to do with student unions, they are at risk of losing their federal funding. It's a big deal.
I know, and I'm happy that it's a big deal, because this is anti-Semitism, as I said.
That's what they're saying. And the difference is that they're saying, but you see, they're taking your point, because Title VI protections had been for, you were not allowed to harass students or anybody on campus based on a place of origin, recognizing them as a people. This is recognized, and they said, well, Jewish students don't count because religion was not included in the original protected groups. What they're saying is, no, Jews are different. They're recognizing Jews, if you will, as a two-pronged organism, and try to take, we are a religion, we are a faith-based group, of course, but we are also a people. And the president recognized that. I'm wondering how Israel is going to use that wonderful new tool in talking and helping students on campus. How can you use that, and how can we help you?
We don't use it directly, of course, because this is something for the United States, but we are totally in favor of that. I think Israeli officials were speaking in favor of that. And we are looking forward for the American administration to use it. And what we would like to see happening is that this would not be based on an executive order of the president, but that is the major step forward that has to be taken in order to make sure that the American government as a whole understands that this is anti-Semitism and they would not tolerate it.
So what you're saying is that maybe this should be when journalists or anybody, any town hall, has a chance to question Democrats who are running now for office, whether Biden is going to be the candidate or anybody else running for the Senate or House, that this should be a question we ask. Will you vote to extend Title VI protection?
Exactly. I think this should be done. And if this is going to be extended, then I think that... there was a very interesting couple of papers recently written by people from the BDS, leading the BDS. And they point at the achievements that their opponents, namely the pro-Israel groups, have recently, and amongst them this executive order of the president. They look at it, they try to minimize its impact, say, okay, it's a short-term problem, because they probably hope that the president will be replaced and Bernie Sanders or something, somebody like that would be the president. But still, they try to minimize it. But at the same time, in between the lines, you understand that they are very concerned. And this is about what I said before, about moving from defense to offense. This is moving on the offense. And in that respect, like many other moves by President Trump, Israel should be very grateful.
Great. Thank you, Susan. And thank you, Yossi. I'm going to try to move to a few other questions. And just as a separate note, obviously, you know, everybody on the call knows that SPME has been deeply involved in the issues of Title VI for the past 20-some years. And it's an ongoing issue. And these are, again, another key in our toolbox as far as to fight the anti-Semitism on campus as it relates to student and faculty. And, you know, we have discussed that over the years and on these calls as well, and we'll continue to do that. Let me go down. There are a few questions to read here. So there is a question from Amos Noor. And he is asking, what is the ultimate solution to the conflict as it relates now, if not a two-state solution, that he's asking about? You want to tackle that, Yossi?
Okay, so right now we are faced with the President Trump vision of peace and prosperity, and the government has to accept it. And if it does, we move on into uncharted territory. Where the Palestinians have to operate under new assumptions. Because until now, the way to handle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was that the Palestinians had a veto power. And because of that, nobody could have moved towards a solution unless we accepted the 7 points of the Palestinians. And they would not go for any solution that was in any contradiction to the 7 points. Namely, they would not accept a Jewish state, and they would keep open the option of turning the entire territory into Palestine, and they would insist on that Israel would accept that the refugees have a right to return, even if they don't immediately return, and then so on and so forth. All kinds of things that were totally unacceptable, and that they have the right to struggle against Israel until all of that happens. And because of that, they have the right to pay salaries to terrorists and so on and so forth. Now, for the first time, comes a plan that tells the Palestinians, listen, you don't have a veto power. And you either accept it, or if you don't, we move forward without you. And this is the idea of applying the Israeli law to the settlements in Judea and Samaria if Israel accepts the plan. And in 4 years, if the Palestinians don't move forward in 4 years, Israel will have the right also to build in more territories that are now kept for the Palestinian future state. That will be accepted only if this paradigm if this narrative is changed. I think this is a much better idea than what we had before, because we couldn't move towards peace before, And we were stuck in a situation which we call the status quo. The status quo was not terrible from an Israeli point of view. What was definitely not the best the best option. Now we are moving, and with this pressure and with the carrots as well, with $50 billion hanging there and promised to the Palestinians, and with the option of having a state of their own if they decide to accept, then we have an opportunity. Much depends on what the pragmatic Arabs are going to do. And you have to understand that today there's a big battle in the Arab world between the radicals and the Palestinians on the one hand, and the pragmatists on the other hand. It's not because of Israel, it's because of attitudes to Iran as well, but and questions of ideological questions regarding what is Islam and so on and so forth. But it's also about the Palestinians. And I don't know to what extent you follow what's happening right now, but there's a big battle because of the Ramadan series and what's happening with them. And the hashtag Palestine is not my problem is very popular today in the Gulf. And the Palestinians understand that they cannot rely on the Arabs anymore. This really makes them scared. And it's a unique opportunity here to make the Palestinians understand that they cannot stick to this narrative. Now, there cannot be a peace. There cannot be any kind of peace without the Palestinians changing the narrative. There can be one unilateral steps taken, but there cannot be a real peace. The Palestinians for now are doing everything in order to stop that from moving forward, hoping that by November things will change. I don't know, of course, but if they are faced with a situation that Trump stays for 4 more years, then they will have to reconsider. Right now, they just look at it and then curse and worried very much about the approach of the pragmatic states. We saw the Palestinian Prime Minister Shtia coming out, apologizing to the Saudis and the caricatures on Twitter against them by Palestinians, saying, no, these are only a few Palestinians, it's not our attitude, but in fact, all of the Palestinians are in it on social media. And it's a very strange situation for the Palestinians to understand that they are losing the Arab world. That's where we stand right now.
Thank you. Of course, sure, you know, there's no short answers or any short questions to any of these issues. Talk to my friend here, Andrea in Canada, and see and have her ask her question. Andrea, can you hear us? Andrea?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. My question is about the actions by the BDS in Israel itself. It doesn't appear that the universities that have BDS supporting professors or organizations, NGOs funded by the EU, are being as challenged now as you would see in America under Title VI. And for decades, I've wondered why the education of Arab children throughout Israel and the territories has not been challenged by Israel, given that those 7 points outlined by Alan are all part of their curriculum.
So let me tell you, yes.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
First of all, I tell you something. For 20 years, we were totally closing our eyes on what's happening. We believe that we have an agreement with the Palestinians, the Oslo Agreement, and this is the sign of a new world in which we are moving towards some wonderful peace. And we didn't understand, even after the terror attack started, there were terror attacks all the time, but even after the Second Intifada started, we were still trying to, some of our leadership was trying to convince itself that there's nothing to worry about, and eventually there's going to be peace. I still remember before 2002, before the massacre on the Seder night in 2002, that we were still working with with Zini, the envoy from the United States, to work out 7 days of non-violence, so we shall be able to make peace. It's totally misunderstanding of the situation, totally misunderstanding what leads the Palestinians. and what how dangerous it is. I think that the first time we woke up to this was in 2009 with the Goldstone report, when a Zionist Jew from South Africa was ready to say about us that we attacked the grain silos in Gaza in order to starve the population Kestled operation in 2009. Then we realized, well, we have a problem. Until then, we had the Niv Gordon and all kinds of professors controlling, taking over the Israeli academia. It was unbelievable. Nobody noticed. Nobody paid attention to this process. And when we woke up, the situation was already extremely grave. And every attempt by the government since then to change something in academia was faced with sharp opposition, and it hasn't been easy. Yes, it's really amazing that the United States took steps that we haven't taken. Although there are all kinds of small things here and there, but still we are far from where we need to be in making sure that government money is not spent on attacking the existence of Israel. This is crazy. And let me finish with, in this respect, with one short story. One day I was sitting in the Ministry of Education and going over the books about Ezrachut, how do you call it?
Citizenship.
Good citizenship, yes. And I was sitting with the director of the pedagogic matters in the ministry. And he told me that the person who wrote some of the versions that they use today in the in schools is Ilan Pape. Are you serious? And he said yes. And now we are working on new versions. That's how far we went on those matters.
That's this is of course part of the problem that we deal with here all the time, and the part of the problem that we at SPME have dealt with at large, the misnomers that you have of what the Israeli perspective is here on American college campuses, when we've had the token, as you know so well, just to add to to amplify your point. The perception is, that you have, if you have an Israeli on campus, even though he may support his or her views, may support exactly the Pape or Niftachtal's Niv Gordon views, then the panel or the center, in Israel studies is balanced. I mean, this is exactly what you find on a lot of issues in North America, and clearly there's a lot that needs to be done. Inside the Israeli Academy, but people don't think about that, which I think is again part of that lost translation.
This is one of the problems of this new anti-Semitism. In the old anti-Semitism, whether it was religious or racial, Jews couldn't have been anti-Semites. But in this new anti-Semitism, for the first time, Jews have the opportunity to become anti-Semites themselves. And they use this ability to stand on both sides of the coin. They are Jews and they are anti-Semites.
So we're moving up in the world, huh?
Yeah.
All right. So I think we have time for one more question. I know our time is short. And I know people have a lot of questions. But if we don't get to your question today, you could always email us, putting it out there at bdsmonitor@spme.org, bdsmonitor@spme.org. And if we don't get to your question today, you can continue on with the conversation, and we will we'll be able to answer your questions later on. Let me take Bibi's question here. Bibi, can you hear us?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, go ahead. The floor is yours.
Great. Okay. As you would know it, a telephone call just came in on my cell phone. But let me ask this question. First, I want to thank the speaker for a very concise and informative talk. I'm not a political scientist. I'm not a particularly political person. I'm actually a biostatistician and epidemiologist.
Important these days.
Yes, thank you. So at a dinner party, I just going to relate a quick personal story. At a dinner party, the issue of Israel came up, and I don't know how it came up or who brought it up, but the spouse of a colleague then became very emotional, and he started to declare Israel is a fascist state. Israel's a fascist state. When I tried to respond, even very mildly, he started to cry and get very emotional. And basically everyone around me just sort of looked at me and said, you can't bring this up, bud, at this time. So you had said that when you see something like this, you know, you want to confront it, call a spade a spade. But I wanted to get some advice. If something like this happens in the future and it becomes impossible to call a spade, what your advice might be.
Well, I don't recommend shouting back. I think that if somebody says, you should ask him, what do you mean? In what way is it? And then be able to answer. And I think we should be all knowledgeable about the truth. Israel is not a fascist state. And it's very easy to prove that. So it's just to speak on that issue is easy. I recommend for every one of you to look at my article in Tablet. There's an article I wrote in Tablet a couple of months ago on the peaceful movement to destroy Israel on BDS. And it's made of setting the record straight on each and every topic, including on the issue of Israel being a fascist state and Israel an apartheid state and so on and so forth. So I this can help in coping with these kind of things. There's no point in shouting back. It's, this never helps. But the problem is, of course, that many people, many liberals, just as I said, adopted the vocabulary. Gaza is the biggest prison on earth. Israel is a fascist state. Israel is a colonialist, and so on and so forth. And on all of these issues, I tried to set the record straight in that article that I wrote about the BDS.
Right. I failed to mention that those very strong statements are always accompanied by, but I'm not an anti-Semite.
Yeah, of course. I believe him. He's not an anti-Semite, probably. But what he's saying is anti-Semitic, okay? So he's a non-anti-Semite that uses, many non-anti-Semites use anti-Semitic tropes. And against Israel, and they believe that because it's against Israel that protects them from being anti-Semites. And I recommend both this and then my article on the anti-Semitism, the new anti-Semitism threat to national security, where I also deal with that approach of the many liberal Democrats. I'm sure that they are committed to high values and so on and so forth. I'm sure them, don't have a doubt about that. And I'm sure many of them are not anti-Semites in the sense that they think that Jews have a long nose and control the world. But anti-Semitism has morphed. People understand that they cannot speak this way. So in order to express their anti-Semitic ideas, they speak about Israel. And that's the point of the IHRA. The first to understand it were the people who lived in the Soviet Union at the time, when this whole idea of Judaism, of Zionism equals racism, came up in the 70s. This was the way the Soviets did it, and people in the liberal left today in the West are actually playing the game of the Soviets in the 70s and 60s. The Russians have given it up already, but those die-hard people couldn't give it up, and they still believe in it. And they should understand. I think they should read more about what's really the situation, or come to Israel. What you should say also to this person is, come to Israel to see in your own eyes. We should be more than happy to host this person. Give him my number, and I'll be more than happy to host him here once this corona is over, and show him what is the truth about what's happening in Israel.
Can I just make two quick yes. points related to that?
Go ahead, Alex.
The first is that terms like fascism are thrown around all the time without anybody having any idea what they mean. And that's a symptom of pervasive ignorance about politics and about forms of politics and about history. But the second point is that when you find people who are willing to cry or scream or have these kinds of overwrought emotional reactions at the dinner table or other kinds of settings, what you're seeing is a religious response. And this is part of a political religion. And it was just pointed out that this was this kind of terminology or interpretation that Zionism is a form of racism that goes back to the Soviet Union and from the 50s and the 1960s. It's part of a political ideology that is deeply, deeply held as a religious belief. You know, people like to say that we live in an era of secularization and secular beliefs, but that's anything but true. We live in an era that is more religious than ever before, or it's as religious as any other period. It's just that we've substituted other kinds of terms and beliefs and structures for the traditional sorts of structures. And belief in angels and demons is among the oldest religious beliefs of humanity. And in this current structure and in this new anti-Semitism, which is ostensibly political, Jews and Israel and the United States play the role of the demons, the great Satan and the little Satan. And not coincidentally, this is very much an Islamic kind of conception that meshes very well with a communist, the traditional 20th century communist conception. And so, you know, when you see somebody who becomes agitated at this idea of Israel, a fascist state, and or America as you know, the source of all evil in the world, I think it's important to realize that you're dealing with somebody who has a deeply held religious belief, and you can go from there and decide if you want to confront them or not, you know, over the dinner table, may or may not be the best setting. But they may or may not be educable in that setting, or at the very least, it's going to be a long and involved process that will last until dessert and coffee and maybe into the next day. So,
yeah.
Great. Well, thank you both. Obviously, we've tackled a lot of issues here, a lot to discuss. And Yossi, I want to thank you again for the comprehensive analysis. And obviously, I think it's critical the fact that you pointed that this is a now become and understood to be a national security problem and not just a problem that, you know, Israelis face outside of Israel and is not seeping into Israeli society. So there's a lot to be worked on. So thank you, of course, you know, for all you do in Israel. You know, we appreciate everything you do, and, you know, we anything we could do to help from our side, you know, of course, we are here as willing and able partners. So I really want to take this opportunity again to thank you for joining us this afternoon, you know, and for all your time and your analysis. I also want to thank Alex, as always, for being with us and for, you know, for your analysis. Alex, any final words on your end before we wrap up for today?
No, I just I'll offer my thanks as well. And thanks also to the audience. There were lots of people who signed up, lots of people who tuned in. And we appreciate it. And I think the main thing is that everybody in the short term should stay healthy.
Agreed. So
we'll see you again.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, Asaf. Thank you, Alex.
Thank you for what you're
doing for Israel. It's really extremely important. Thank you very much.
Thank you for everybody. And again, if we didn't get to your question today, feel free to, again, email us at bdsmonitor@spme.org. As Alex said, you know, and Yossi, please stay healthy and safe during this time, and we will continue these conversations, in the next week or so. So thank you very much, and have a good afternoon. Yossi, thank you again.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Take care.